sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Fed helps to rally stocks. But Greece smacks them down. Deals are everywhere. The healthcare sector is booming. And we saw that CPI was up, but not so much to be too concerned about. And our guest today is Serge Berger, the Steady Trader. We're going to talk with him and a lot more. Stick around for episode number 418 on this Father's Day of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, yeah, it is Father's Day, and happy Father's Day to everyone out there. Andrew Horowitz here, and it is the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hopefully you had a great day. I did some really cool smoking of some meats. I did, turkey legs, and I'm in for about 3 hours, and apple wood. And in my, I have one of those rectangular up and down smokers, and you put it on about, about 250 to 260 degrees and kind of let it go for a while. Actually put a big chunk of what's called pork butt in there also to make a pulled pork. And that, I guess I started that about 9 in the morning and pulled it out about 4 in the afternoon. It was just right. Probably could have used a little bit more time, maybe another half hour, but it was just really smoky, really great. If you haven't done any smoking of meats or other, you know, fish, whatever it may be, maybe make a fish dip out of it. Smoking is a lot of fun, very time consuming. But a lot of fun. Had the whole family over, and it was a good time. So I just wanted to wish everybody out there a happy Father's Day. And hopefully, again, like you had a good time. Now, let's talk about some of the things that are happening in the market before we get to our guest. There was an interesting week that was, and we have some news of what may be expected in the next week. But last week, the Federal Reserve left interest rates alone, but its median federal funds forecast for the end of 2015 is now at about 0.625, and that was it would seem to suggest that multiple adjustments to the key interest rate in the last half of this year is going to go on. But Janet Yellen, the Fed chair, made some comments that the central bank is looking for more decisive evidence that a moderate pace of economic growth will be sustained before making any move. So every time they say one thing, they kind of come back with, on the other hand. That seems to be a interesting course of action. It also seems, some commentary last week about, well, if the Fed doesn't like or the information is contrary to their central tenets of where they think things are, it's transitory. You know, that's the comments they make. It's just transitory. It's going to change and come to their equation. But it's interesting that they did adjust down GDP for 2015 to 1.8 to 2%. And that's down from a range of 2.3 to 2.7% they had this spring. So even though all this stuff was transitory, let's just face facts that the Fed was wrong. They were wrong in their estimates, and who knows if they're right or wrong now on the low or the high side. Point being that the Fed is pretty poor at doing any kind of estimates of economic growth, and I think it's been pretty well telegraphed and commented, written about, and documented that they really don't do a great job at economic forecast, which is their job, by the way. So that's something that I want you to think about. Now, when we look at what also went on that was interesting last week was that CPI, from an economic standpoint, was up 0.4% in May. But if you look at what really were the components of that, well, gas prices soared 10.5% last month. And that was a notable rise in the component that was added to consumer prices. So the Federal Reserve maybe won't be too concerned with the 1 month advance, however. So that's the big issue right there. So the core, which strips out the energy and the food prices, was up only 0.1%. So, not a big deal. Now, housing starts were up. Building permits were up, but this is a pretty volatile number. You know, you got to look at this on an ongoing basis. And on a kind of a longer-term average, it's been slowing down a bit, but still in a good state. You know, overall, I think that when it comes to the building, again, you can probably pick up pockets of maybe some particular pricing and some particular areas that aren't doing as well. But generally speaking, when you look at the totality of it right now, things are looking okay. Now, stocks, what happened there? Well, we saw that the NASDAQ composite rose about 1.3%, which outpaced both the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And the blue chips, the Dow, added about 0.65%. Now, you remember what happened there? There was a little bit of a kind of a dull moment on the actual commentary of the Fed. And the next day, all of a sudden, everybody was excited. It could have been because of the CPI was muted, or could have been because there was some hope for the fact that there was going to be maybe something out of Greece that was going to be good. It could have been just simply the fact that there was an oversold situation that was building pretty well. But whatever the case was, we saw that V happen again, a big move on Thursday that rallied the markets pretty well. Friday, when the fact came to light that Greece had no plan and it looks like that there was nothing that the EU was going to agree to, and look at Merkel and various parties in Europe was pretty much said that, you know, hey, this is a joke. When they walked down on a meeting after 45 minutes, all of this put together seems to make it look like there's really not much that either party at this point is willing to compromise anymore. But nonetheless, there was a rise on the 5 days, the full 5 days of the week, for about 0.65 for the Dow Jones, just a hair above 18,000 and change. S&P rose about 0.75% for the week, finished right at about 2110, give or take. Now, what's coming up next week? Well, we have the National Association of Realtors. They're going to be presenting their existing home sales figures this week coming up. We're going to see Carnival Cruise Lines announce their results. On Tuesday, we're going to see the May Durable Goods and New Home Sales Report. Now, the durable goods over the last several months has been pretty sloppy. We've seen a variety of reasons why. A lot of it has to do with the dollar. A lot of it has to do with a tremendous amount of airline bookings. Well, not bookings of people flying, but companies buying aircraft. And that was pretty significant, and it really rallied durable goods dramatically and then brought them back, if you remember that. So hopefully we're going to see a little bit of a smoothing out of that and maybe return to normality of durable goods. We're also going to see the final estimates of quarter one GDP on Wednesday. Now, that's going to be pretty interesting because it was revised, as you recall, to a negative, and there's been some concern about where that's going to go. And the whole idea that, well, maybe the first quarter on a regular basis is always light, and therefore there's some problem with the calculation of GDP. So we're going to see that revision come out, and it will be the final. I'm interested in seeing how that's going to play out and whether or not we're going to see, in the end, an actual positive point on GDP for the first quarter. There's some earnings that are coming out also on Wednesday: Nike, Lennar, Winnebago, Bed Bath & Beyond, and Monsanto. Now, Thursday, personal spending is going to be out. New initial claims, which has been running well under 300,000, which is pointing towards the continuation of a very decent jobs and employment situation. And then on Friday, we're going to see the University of Michigan's final June Consumer Sentiment Index, which is oftentimes a market mover. So we're going to watch that. And, you know, generally speaking, consumer sentiment, while it did fall from the highs that we did see, has been holding up pretty well, all things being, you know, all things considered. Now, over the weekend, there was some talk about, hey, this is going to be the final and we're going to really do something and we're going to, you know, we're going to, yes, it's all good from Greece, you know, that kind of commentary that, yeah, we have a good plan and an absolute, and this is going to work and all that. But again, we saw a lot of denial from the other side, and we'll see what happens, because really at this point we're getting to a level where Greece is going to have to realize that they're going to have to cave in a bit because the other side is just not willing to give a lot. But I will mention that even with all that going on, when the fact is that Greece is pretty much so far said, hey, screw you, Europe, we're not going along with the plan, Europe and the ECB has been continuing to provide liquidity to the banking sector. A lot of money has been running out of the banking sector, and they need funds to continue with their required levels of reserves. So the ELA, which is a loan program for banks, have been pumping continued money. As a matter of fact, I believe on Friday there was another $2 billion released from the EU, from ECB, to the banks to keep them afloat, because there is some concern that on Monday morning, lo and behold, we're going to see a bank closure, a stop of assets being moved out of the country, and capital controls put on. And the potential was, and the headline was, that Greece may not have the ability to keep their banks open on Monday. Now, with that, the Hail Mary weekend, you know, before markets open, for God forbid markets get upset. You know, God forbid a couple of days go by that the markets actually are concerned about anything because, you know, we didn't do our job to properly plan, which, by the way, they didn't. None of this is working out the way they plan to, but you know what? We have to do what we can to keep markets afloat, even if it's just words. And if you think about it just for a second, really, over the last, I would say, the last month, and probably could take it back a few months, but over the last month or so, really, this has been a bunch of lies and BS that's been going on with all of the commentary from both sides of the field here, with both the ECB, EU, whether it was any of the particular countries, and Greece on the other side. The fact of the matter is, I mean, there's no way to put pencil and paper to any of this because they're lying across the board. They tell you there's a deal done, but it's not. They tell you what it's going to consist of, but truth be known, it's not at all like that. At the end of the day, there is no information to go on. There really isn't. The only thing I can tell you is that it seems that from all evidence that it makes sense to keep Greece in the Eurozone. To allow for them to fail would be catastrophic, even though they're not saying that out loud. What they are telling you is that they can handle it, which tells me they can't. If they're trying so hard to provide us with every piece of evidence to show us that, well, hey, things aren't that bad. And if Greece does, in fact, extract themselves by either force on our part or their part from the Eurozone, not a big deal. I think they're saying that without knowledge truly of the impact. And the fact is they're just trying to pacify markets. That's what their job is. Federal bankers and central bankers and Federal Reserve and ECB, et cetera, all they are about is pacifying markets, keeping control of price stability. Remember, that's one of their edicts, price stability. Price stability in markets, not only in, as I see it, you could say, well, that's really about inflation. Yeah, but it's also about markets. And if it wasn't in the past, it is now, I'll tell you right now. So keep that in mind. Couple things I want to mention to you that Serge Berger is coming on very shortly. We're going to talk to him. There's a free book that you can get, a free ebook. It's over on The Disciplined Investor in the show notes of this particular episode. Grab that. I want to wish a happy Father's Day to Corey at Kraken Marine. This is a guy that helps me on my boat quite often. I told him to give him a quick shout out. And a great father and expecting a new one any day now. So happy Father's Day, Corey, to you. And I also want to mention that if you haven't gotten it yet, TradeStation is offering you the 30-day free, it's not even a trial, it's more like a complete demo. In other words, you get their software without having to open an account. You don't have to put any money in, you don't have to open an account per se. All you do is pretty much just sign up, download the software, and you get 30 days. Now, one of the things you could do is you can use the codes that we have that we put on the episode notes, and we've kind of floated around a few different times. And you can get our indicators as well for a 10-day free trial on that. So check that out and make sure that you check it out. If you haven't used TradeStation, and this is not a paid commercial, it's not a commercial that they're asking me to do. I'm telling you for a fact. I mean, it's one of the best platforms out there for charting, technical analysis, and for utilizing third-party indicators. Really some stupendous stuff that's on there, and I really encourage you to check that out. One last thing that I'll mention is that we saw that there's a variety of commentary and news headlines coming out about Aetna and Cigna and Humana. There is the potential for a deal on the table, a few different variations of things that are going on. So Monday morning, you're going to see some movement in these particular stocks. What I find most interesting about these is if you've looked at their stocks and their charts lately, they've been doing extremely well. you know, with all that has happened with Obamacare and the fact that we've really added a lot more people to the insurance rolls, you would have initially thought, and we all thought back when, just at first glance without really looking into the data, that, hey, you know what? Maybe this is going to be a problem for the hospitals and the insurance companies. But lo and behold, it's a bonanza. It's been great. I mean, you got more people on. They're paying more money. You pretty much got a guaranteed income if you're the HMO. And so all sorts of great things. Look at what's going on with these companies. I mean, I got to tell you, I don't know how it's going to bring down the cost of healthcare, but it has been very, very good for the healthcare companies. Maybe that was the intention all along. Anyway, let's get to our guest. We'll see what he has to say. And our guest today is Serge Berger, known as the Steady Trader. He is and has been a fixed income analyst at JP Morgan. He's a prop trader and has been doing trading in equity and options and futures and has a lot of experience in that area. And I wanted to bring him on for a couple different reasons. He's has a subscription available through MarketFi. He has newsletters available, courses, et cetera. But I wanted to find out more about his whole technique about finding and identifying stocks, when to buy, when to sell, what's a good stock, what are some of the signals, et cetera. So welcome to the show, Serge.
Andrew, it's good to be on. Thank you so much.
So I wanted to start with the whole idea of maybe telling us what is a good stock, how do you find it, what's the process, and then kind of maybe bore down into the intricacies of some of the things that you look for as the most important areas.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, for me, as originally a fixed income oriented person, you know, I tend to look at things a little bit more a mix of top down and bottom up. So I like to understand what the bigger picture things are. So I don't like to fight major central banks and things like that. At the same time, you know, having sort of obviously exposure to the real trading world, you don't really want to go against the actual, you know, real technical trends that are happening either. So it's a little bit of a mix of both. And I think from a risk management perspective, that has actually always helped me to get the best out of it, you know, to the extent one can in today's quite central bank focused markets.
So are only central bank focused, it seems, you know, at least for the last few years. And clearly, if you watch any of the news, it's really kind of amazing how it's almost a fetish / fascination with, oh, when are they going to raise? How much are they going to raise? What does it mean to raise? It's almost like there's a process going on and very wisely programmed to get the investor to kind of become complacent about the whole thing and become background noise versus a surprise, don't you think?
I think so. And you know, but that's the times we live in. And I think that's sort of my point. You know, I think we need to adjust to it. And that's why if you strictly go, you know, bottom up or top down, you have these problems that you haven't really had in at least since I've been alive and a trader. So it's just is what it is. And I find a lot of people that have been fighting this tape in the professional circuit for the past 6 years, just, you know, trying to find bearish trades. And after every little dip, they just get their faces ripped off again. And that's, you know, not really something that's sustainable through the longer lens.
Yeah, the big question is going to be, though, when are they right? But that's a whole different discussion. I mean, we hedge out in our portfolios. And, you know, as you've noticed, we'll talk about 2015 as an example. As you notice that every move down to whether it's a technical support line or just what seems to be, wow, that markets moved down 2%, it's met with a V pattern, which actually I wrote about today, but a V pattern that is, you know, we could be going down for, let's just say, dripping down for 2 weeks, let's just say. And then one day, boom, it could be on no news, it could be on some news, but it almost looks like it's a constant short squeeze that is based on a lot of liquidity and fake out, and it's kind of interesting. But when you talk about top down versus bottoms up, do you have a particular way that you like to look at things on a fundamental basis?
I try not to get too fundamental on things. What I mean more is sort of a structural thing. So I try to really, I spend a lot of time looking at central bank activity. I closely monitor some of these, or I used to at least for the first few years, the QE programs and things like that. I don't want to fight major trends. And these days, I think there's just much more focus on the bigger picture, as you say, central bank stuff. And so I don't want to get caught on the wrong side of that. The trick to the trade has been basically respecting the V-shaped reversals. You know, I mean, look at the Russell 2000 just the past few weeks, or last October was the real rage. And I don't think you could have caught that from a fundamental perspective, you know. So through a technical lens, then I overlay that and I look at a lot of ratio charts. I'm a big ratio chart guy. So I like to look at things in relative terms as well as in absolute terms. But I think relative stuff has really, really helped me stay on the right side of the market for the most part, and at least not fight major trends.
So does that mean that when we talk about relative, so it's a comparative against two. So let's take, and I'm assuming you're using sectors as an example, or maybe even major market indices, you know, the S&P 500 versus maybe domestically the small caps versus maybe the DAX versus something else. But are you saying that you like to look at a rotation basis where you're finding that, hey, this is really overdone comparatively and ratio-wise to the downside, and I'm going to buy that because it's going to pick back up? Or are you saying that you're going to follow the ones that are far outpacing the others to keep going with that momentum and trend?
Great question, and I tend to do both. Quite frankly, it's worked a little bit better. Just kind of, you know, basically what I do is I apply technical analysis on the ratio. So let's say I look at the financials ETF, the XLF versus the spiders, the SPY, the S&P 500. I then overlay, you know, sort of straight technical analysis. If there's a breakout happening on that, I'll play that. But if also, for example, within a sector, let's say Walmart has been a huge underperformer in the staples, right? Mm-hmm. So to me, that's also a game, you know, trade to do. Even though the staples don't look good to me right now in general, you know, at least from a relative perspective within that sector, the Walmart's been so beaten up. I like that as well. So sort of as a bottom fishing trade, if you will.
So it's like a reversion trade. Now, that's an interesting question. Yeah. You know, I don't, you know, I could, when I think about Walmart, I think of it as a retail, which then you could put into the bucket of consumer discretionary. On the other hand, milk, cereal, you know, because Walmart has gone from what Walmart was to what Walmart is today. And a lot of the superstores have other things aside from, let's call it Walmart stuff, you know, clothing, things like that, that people would think about, because they all have supermarkets, or a lot of them have supermarkets in it now. You can have paint, you have, you know, you have bicycles, you know, whatever else it is, aside from just what Walmart was back then, right? Walmart was the cheap product back then. I don't know about you, but I could shop in Walmart. There's plenty of stuff in there.
Oh, I do. Yeah. I have no shame in that.
Yeah. No, but it's interesting. It you consider it a staple, which I find really interesting. I mean, it's would you consider Target a staple as well? Target stores?
I think retailers, I mean, you hit it right in the head. I think retailers are a little bit difficult, especially the big ones like that, to you know, to dump into one specific place. I just had to kind of pick a spot. I mean, quite frankly, whether I pinned Walmart versus the staples or versus the discretionary, it didn't really matter. It was a massive underperformer. So from that perspective, you know, the ratio was still, you know, very, very low, if you will.
You know, if you really think about it for a second, just to kind of go on this topic for just one more second, if you think mm-hmm. about what Walmart is, it could kind of be in a way a materials company. It can kind of be in a way a healthcare company, right? I mean, it has all of that.
Yeah.
It has all those things that are, you know, it's a retailer, but it has all those, it's on the retail side of all those, but it's just, it's everything. It's the Walmart is the economy.
It is, you know, and you can make the argument for things like a Tesla, right? So, I mean, this is something I talk to people a lot about. And so Tesla, to me, yes, I know they make cars, but I mean, is it really a car company? If you know, like, I mean, I suppose you can make the argument for almost any car company nowadays, right? Because it's all basically just computers on wheels. But Tesla's even more so, because it's not even a real, you know, motor, or at least not a fuel motor, right?
I think Tesla is actually, if you were to pin me down and say, what is Tesla, you know, I would have to say, aside, you know, if you say besides an automobile company, I would have to say it's an energy company.
That's fair enough too.
You know, yeah. I mean, I think
my point is, it's more difficult because of all the technology.
Yeah.
I think it's become more difficult to pin those types of companies that use a lot of technology into just one specific place.
Yep, I hear you. So Walmart, I know that this is on a list of things that you recently initiated a position mm-hmm. on the 9th of June. And so you did that from a relative standpoint. You looked at the various markets. You looked at other stocks in the sector. You looked at other stocks just out there. And you said that Walmart is one of those that should come back. And now this is all predicated on the fact that we have a continuation of a bull market, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, if you just want to quickly back up to the technicals again, it's the ratio, it's the relative weakness that I saw. But then, of course, once I saw that, I also looked at the absolute chart, and Walmart has now, at least for a bounce, I think, reached a very good multi-year lateral support area.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I got you.
So that's sort of more in the technicals again.
Now, let's just get back to some of the core stuff. I know that you write from MarketFi. Now, MarketFi is I guess it is. It's with Benzinga, right? It has a relationship with Benzinga. And can you tell me a little bit more about, because I know about MarketFi, but I just want to just a little bit more about what's available and what the whole point of it is?
Sure. So, I mean, MarketFi is essentially a little bit of a store for various newsletter trader products, such as what I have. So people can follow me along, you know, trade by trade and really understand the rationale behind it. So it's almost like sitting, you know, at my desk, kind of, you know, listening to all the conversations I have with hedge funds and everyone all day long and seeing the rationale for a trade. So what MarketFi does is it sort of provides me with a technology platform to offer such a trade alert service. So I don't have to worry about going in and doing things like customer service, you know, directly. They do a lot of that stuff. So it's to me, it's a good technology platform. And for the end customer, there's, you know, various guys like me out there that offer their, you know, sort of the cockpit.
Right.
Seat.
So I know that you looked at dividing the markets into different time frames and characters, and you kind of look at things, and a big point of what you write about is that, you know, you want to make these unemotional decisions. Now, you mentioned that technicals you like, at least right now, over fundamentals. And the technicals that you look at, you mentioned, were the relative performance or ratios. What other technicals do you look at, and what other things do you look at when you're looking at a chart?
So a lot of it starts, like I said, with the relative weakness, relative strength, but, you know, still keeping in mind the bigger picture. For example, let's look at the financials year-to-date. Look at the XLF or the BKX, the banks. Divide any of those by the S&P, we've seen relative strength all year long. It's because we've had, at least at the margin, you know, rising rates so far. So once I see that, I wouldn't want to fight that. But then, you know, I then go into the individual charts, say Bank of America, which we bought and sold two weeks ago, something like that. You know, but then it's a lot of it comes down to me, sort of called confluence zones, is what I call them. So once I understand the bigger trend, I see the ratio chart working out. So there's relative strength or weakness, and then I pinpoint a stock. I want to make sure I pick up the stock at some sort of confluence support or resistance level of, you know, support if I go long, resistance if I go short. So things come together like various, you know, fairly boring moving averages, Fibonacci stuff, you know, maybe some oscillators that show me a negative or positive divergence. Fairly straightforward stuff. To me, what's more important is that many things line up all together as opposed to, you know, just kind of blindly firing away because the 50-day moving average is now support.
Right. No, I hear you. So now, once you initiate a position, so let's just go back to the Bank of America here. So you initiated Bank of America on the 3rd of June. You sold it on the 12th of June for about a 3.5% gain. Now, that's a short-term swing. How did you decide to sell it on the 12th, and what made you? Was it something that you originally set up on the trade, when you made the trade, when you initiated the trade, or is it something that happened after the fact?
So I'm a big rate of change guy, and to me, the original price target was $18 on that trade. I got out at, you know, I don't know, it sounds like you have more direct access than my portfolio I have right now, my 17-something. And basically, to me, it was just the rate of change was a little bit too quick. So I saw the whole banking sector as a group just got a little bit too frothy in the absolute immediate term. Additionally, I started to raise more cash again as we went into the Fed. I just don't like the whole, you know, these are swing trading positions of, you know, a few days to a few weeks is the average duration. So I don't really feel like being exposed to some, you know, like I don't hold things through earnings for the most part or through sort of binomial outcome events that, like I said, we had, right, had yesterday.
So, you know, we look at the Fed, we look at Greece. These are things that are pretty much the two top headlines. I mean, Russia building nuclear arms. Ah, who cares about that? You know, China being in a bubble, or at least theoretically, and all the things that are going on there with the constant goading of the central bank to, hey, buy stocks, and, you know, 4 million accounts being opened up this week, and people saying, hey, you know what, we're not going to buy cars because why should I buy a car? I'm going to take that money and buy stocks, and I can buy a bigger car one day. on margin, by the way. All these different things that are out there, you know, inclusive of all the currency moves, oil moving lower, earnings kind of slowing down. So the Oracle numbers that look pathetic, all those things in the background. But really, the only thing that seems to matter is the Fed in Greece and probably the Fed, more importantly, in the U.S., Greece, more importantly, in Europe. But what do you see what's going on and how is that going to affect things? Is there a, you know, a change in the dynamic potentially going to be out there from any of these or none?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously the big stuff, right? So this is the stuff that I wake up for in the morning and I get really excited about. It sounds boring, but it's obviously, I mean, you too, this is what we have to focus on, right? This is really where the tailwind is. So to me, Greece, you know, I look at it again through the lens of sort of the fixed income markets, because I think that's actually a little bit more important. They were a lot more important there. But I think, you know, the way I've put it is Greece is more of a summer tantrum that we seem to have now for 4 or 5 years straight. And I think people are getting a little bit tired of it. If I talk to people in Europe, you know, I think, yes, there's a potential structural issue. And it sounds like literally they just walked away from the table.
Well, they walk away every day. They walk away every day. Yeah, you know, that's all exactly. They do. They go in for the, they go. So here's my theory, by the way. You know, Europeans like to eat and drink, right? We know that. So I think what they're doing is that they're serving lunch first and then they're meeting, or they're serving breakfast first or dinner first and then meeting. I think they got to change that. They got to change it to after the meeting, it's required that one movement forward happens and then you get to eat. Otherwise, there's no food.
No, but it's just, if you look at this stuff, it's just pathetic. It's ridiculous. Literally, I was just looking at Twitter. The Twitter feed literally like 15, 20 minutes ago told me that they walked away. And I'm not kidding. It was like 5 minutes later, the Bloomberg headline read, they're meeting on Monday.
Yeah, you know? It's ridiculous.
I mean, how can you take that serious? You know, I honestly don't know a self-respecting hedgie out there that's taken this serious anymore. Unless you are deep into Greek debt restructuring moves, that's a whole different story. I think the Fed's more important. I think, quite frankly, Draghi, to the extent that he can overcome the Greek headlines, you know, the ECB is still more important. But I think what we're seeing here is we're seeing a slowdown in economic – the rate of change has slowed in economic data globally, right? Right. China is an obvious one, and U.S. data too. So to me, I look at the world through the lens of rate of change, like I said. But to me, what's really interesting is I look at it from a cross-asset perspective. So I know you're a big cross-asset guy. So if, you know, rewind the tape 12 months – big volatility started moving in the oil market, so commodities. So we've seen a spike in volatility there. Then we moved over into equities, into foreign exchange. Then, of course, now you know, fixed income volatility. The only thing that hasn't seen any volatility is equity.
None. I mean, you know, and you can't consider 2% movement. That's just noise.
No, it's exactly right. It's noise, and it's just not something you can take serious. So, considering that the world is ever more, you know, interconnected through communications, through debt, through what have you, it cannot be that equities are just going to remain standing there like the knight in shining armor forever without any volatility spikes. So to me, I look at all these dynamics happening. I think equities are sort of the last man standing. They will see a correction of 10 to 15% before we can move higher here in what I still argue to be a big secular bull market with years to go. But, you know, so that's what I see. I see the cross asset volatility. I think the short end of the yield curve has seen more volatility than it should for something that's like extremely, you know, conservative paper, both in Europe and in the U.S. And those things are concerning to me. You know, it's more the structure of the bond market than, you know, it's not like rates went up this year because of economic growth is great. No, they went up because of structural situations in the bond market where there's too much supply and too little liquidity. You know, all the bond desks are shut.
Right. No, exactly. I mean, that's the incremental buyer, though, the majority buyer of bonds over the last several years, particularly of treasuries, was the Fed or Feds, we'll say, around the world. And, you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, when that comes to a halt, if it ever does, it's still buying, I guess, $10 to $15 billion a month that rolling over from interest payments and principal payments. But what's interesting is that, you know, you wonder if you know, this large secular bull market that you talk about that was obviously was initiated by liquidity, low interest rates, and now which is being kind of furthered by, wait a minute, we have all this, you know, low interest rates that we can get money at. Hey, let's do some kind of financing to either do share buybacks, do dividend payments and return of money to shareholders, which obviously helps things and keeps people in. And on top of that, look at the M&A activity that we're seeing right now. You know, whether or not the M&A activity, I think, is towards the end of the bull market due to the fact that, when I say the bull market, related to interest rates, related to interest rates I'm talking about, and they're saying, hey, you know what, we better get on the stick on this thing and get something done because we're not going to see rates this low for a long time. I don't know. What's your take on the share buybacks?
Well, I think the share buybacks, quite frankly, were a function of essentially what you just said, interest rates. And if you look at, you know, and it ties in with other stuff. So if you look at the bond market, I think J.P. Morgan, I read a report a couple of weeks ago, last week, I think. The corporate bond market has seen like $100 billion in issuance 5 months straight. That's never happened. And it's happening now because they're starting to see that, yes, we might get that 25 basis points, you know, rise at some point. But the share buybacks are the same thing. They're just, there's too much you know, money slushing around. I'm not sure the corporations are really seeing the growth they need to see. So just, you know, instead of buying other companies in grand scale, just, you know, buy back your own stock. It kind of makes sense. Maybe you're pleasing investors a little bit that way. But
with regard to the bond issuance and share buybacks, and what you mentioned is that, you know, the JP desk is seeing, you know, all this incredible issuance. I mean, there's really nothing wrong at these low rates, especially if they lock them in for a long period of time. I mean, it's not like, oh, look at all the debt they have and it's variable rate, let's say. No, they're locking in it for a long period of time. And that's actually, you know, very good for the bottom line on, you know, many companies. You know, it depends on how much they issue. I mean, if they go crazy with it, it's another story, you know, because as earnings slow down, it cuts into their profitability that much more. But still, I mean, the fact is that low interest rates, if you can do so and leverage up your position and have enough money in cash, which a lot of them still do due to their structure. So, I mean, it's not the worst thing in the world unless they get a little bit kind of a little bit nutty about it.
I don't think it's a bad thing. I was more saying that it's just, to me, it's a sort of a function of this, of people starting to look towards the exit door, right? In terms of rates sort of slowly rising. And that's going back to the structural issue with, you know, too much issuance versus liquidity, right? And the Fed's aware of that, by the way, right? They've said it several times. It's the same thing. It's just everyone's kind of aware of it. And that, to me, that is where I think we'll see the volatility come from. I think it'll be rates volatility driven, ultimately, it sort of leaking into equities.
And let me just say something. Serge Burker is on the know. He's got a little birdie tweeting in his ear, obviously, telling him all this information. You can hear in the background there. I like that. It's very calming. It's very meditational. I feel very centered as we talk today. The thing is about, just to close this point on interest rates, I was thinking, and I was talking to a few colleagues today and yesterday about this, and the concept of raising interest rates, right? Raising the Fed funds rate, right? So where is the Fed funds rate now? It's at 0 to 0.25%. So if they raise it 0.25%, they're sneaky. You know, the Fed's sneaky, right? You know, they're really in line with the whole idea of building wealth. It's the only tool they really have. So I wonder if they're just going to say, well, we're changing it from 0 to 0.25% to 0.25%. And that's what they would consider a raise. How funny would that be?
Yeah, but I mean, quite frankly, I think that's what they're in for.
Yeah, you know, of course.
It seems to me there's a political motivation here. There's just getting away from that 25 basis points, rate, just getting away from it. You know, I think that's really all they're trying to do. And quite frankly, here's a thought that you don't hear often, at least not yet. If they're going to raise and this rate of change in terms of economic data is going to continue to slow down, do you think they can cut again?
Well, they can. They can do whatever the hell they want.
Exactly. I'm saying, but I'm telling you, no one's thinking about that.
Oh, I mean, I've thought of that 100 times. I'm thinking, well, what happens?
No, but you have, but no one else.
Yeah, I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. They got to raise rates because they need to do something from just they've been talking about it so long. It's like, okay, they got to do something. They got to lay down a little bit of a hammer here. Right. And, you know, on the other hand, if we see all of a sudden manufacturing dry up, what they really need is a nice, strong quarter right now. A strong quarter of economic data, which, by the way, is noisy. We know that. You know, they use the word transient. I don't know if you listen at the FOMC and the conversations and Yellen. I mean, what does she say? Who the hell knows? Nothing. Because every time she says something, she backs it up with debating that point entirely, you know?
Even if she does, you have the next day, you have Bullard or someone coming out and basically just making sure that, you know, it's not misunderstood what you said.
Right.
It's all good.
Or better yet, if the markets don't like it, somebody comes out to counter it.
Well, that's essentially what I meant. Yeah, exactly. And it's sad, but it's really the truth.
It's terribly sad. It really is. It really is terribly sad. It's taken a lot of the, I think, the analysis. Well, it's done two things. It's taken some of the analysis out of equities and all that, which, okay, so fine. It's a new generation, new process. But I think it's creating, I really do think it's creating a terrible sense of complacency in a way that could be very detrimental to people's financial future in the near term.
No, big time. I think, you know, I look at guys that have been, you know, trading markets and, you know, and, you know, guys that are already fairly senior to you know, that you can get in 10 or 6-7 years, they have no clue how to deal with something coming slowing down.
Yeah, like, they do. They're going to just buy on the dip.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Well, there you go.
That's what they're going to do. Buy on the dip. And I've been here before, by the way, just to let you know. I've been here before. I'm not suggesting we're going to see a turn down like we saw back in 07, 08, or even back in 2000s. But I've been around and watching this buy the dip mentality grow over time, and then all of a sudden disappears very quickly when somebody gets shot in the arm. I got to tell you.
Yeah.
So, hey, last point. You mentioned, I think in a recent update, you talked about Salesforce. Now, Salesforce is very interesting. So Oracle comes out with their earnings, and they missed all over the place. And the stock was down about 8% or something like that. And a variety of players are like, oh, Oracle's got to buy Salesforce because of this or that. This, you know, discussing this. Oracle's a database company. They do a little driving of the internet behind the back end. They have Java. A lot of things they do in the back end in terms of making the internet work, okay? Plus other things they have as well. I don't see them as competition to Salesforce. The thing about Salesforce, all these little rumors that come out, Microsoft that it's going to buy them, et cetera. I mean, this would be a very expensive buyout in terms of valuation, not only in dollars, but in valuation for a company. Why is this persisting, this whole thing, when Mark Benioff is a guy that likes to go alone?
Yeah, I don't know what you read. My piece was literally a trade.
It was just a technical discussion.
But still, I mean, it's, you know, I think you bring up a really, really important point, and it's a little bit of the nuttiness we're seeing. You know, is there a little bit of froth in some of this stuff? Yes, but this is an interesting point in and of itself. I'm very skeptical of it, honestly. I just thought, purely from a technical perspective, this thing had a little bit of legs, you know, the way it looked. But I wouldn't bet on this. I mean, they're talking about $90 to be the buyout price, I think. You know, I'm not going to chase it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, if they would have bought this, they could have bought it years ago. And it also, the only fit. I do agree there is a fit, by the way, for Microsoft in a way. There's definitely some fit there. Oracle, I don't see the fit as well, and I don't know if they could afford that. They'd have to go. I think they would be much better off buying smaller deals, and particularly in the security area and all that. That would be a much better gig for Oracle. I also find it very interesting that 1 quarter after Larry Ellison said goodbye, I think it's 1 quarter. Is it 1 quarter? It's about 1 quarter since Larry Ellison said goodbye, right?
I'm trying to think. I know the news is much older than that, but I don't know when he actually.
Maybe it's 2 quarters. Anyway, it's kind of interesting how poorly the stock has done since then. So he's a smart guy, smart fella. He's on his sailing yacht. He's doing his thing. Anyway. Serge Berger, you can find him over at MarketFi, as well as we will have all the ways and get in touch with him on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. The episode for this particular podcast will have links to get to all of his various things, like his swing trading courses, his hot stocks to watch newsletter, which gives you about 1 to 2. I think it's 1 to 2 high probability trades each week, right?
Yeah, that's roughly it. Obviously, it depends on the markets, right. But that's what we average.
Okay, and of course, the MarketFi subscription. So, hey, buddy, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Andrew. Right.
Great. Talk to you.
Good to be on.
Bye-bye. Well, going to wrap it up right there and watch what happens next week with this whole Greek drama, but surely there'll be a little bit under the healthcare stocks, particularly those that are associated with anything, I guess, related to the hospitals / HMOs, insurance companies. We'll call them more the insurance companies maybe than just healthcare. This is more insurance companies than healthcare. But still, in the health-related field, we're going to mention. So just think about that. And I think that depending on what the actual outcome of the Monday meetings are, we're going to have to watch what happens with markets. Right now, it looks like markets are pretty much pricing in the fact that there's some concern out there, but they're not worried. They think that the whole Greece deal will be put to bed. And that's good. We'll see how that plays out. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.